Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter confirmed on Sunday that Sudan's President Omar Hassan al-Bashir had said he is ready to pull troops from a disputed border area with South Sudan. He described it as a major step toward achieving peace between the neighbors. Sudan and South Sudan have been at loggerheads over a string of disputes since the southern nation declared independence in July last. Clashes near the disputed border raised fears of an all-out war last month. The 2005 peace pact that paved the way for southern secession ended decades of war between the two sides, but they have failed to agree on the position of their shared border, division of debt, and the status of disputed areas, including Abyei. Lydia O'Kane spoke to former head of the UN in Sudan and special representative of the Ageist Trust, Mukesh Kapila, who says the conflict is taking its toll on civilians.
How much is the lack of resolution in the comprehensive peace agreement to blame for what's happening now in these provinces of North Kordofan and the Blue Nile?
I think the uncompleted business of the CPA is virtually totally responsible for what's going on in South Kordofan and Blue Nile. And this is because in the haste to make the settlement that was done, understandably so, all those years ago, these long-disputed regions were sacrificed to the altar of an accommodation between Khartoum and Juba. And unfortunately, they've been sold down the line, so to speak, resulting in the fact that this unfinished grievances of the people there have continued to fester to a point that they are now incredibly serious.
Looking at Sudan and South Sudan, we saw the cessation of South Sudan last year, but there seemed to be a problem with regard to a vagueness of borders. Why weren't the borders properly defined last July?
The borders were not properly defined in the CPA because the assumption made was that the two new states, Sudan and South Sudan, eventually would, in good faith, work together to resolve those uncertainties. This was based on the assumption that you could do normal business with a normal government in Khartoum. But the problem has been that the government in Khartoum is headed by an indicted war criminal, and the notion that you can do normal business with a genocidal regime who would behave, therefore, rationally and in a trustworthy way has been not borne by the evolution of history. So that's where it all lies. There can be no resolution of this until we have a democratic and sensible government in Khartoum with whom you can trust. Khartoum has never, in all its history, ever honoured an agreement that is ever signed.
So really, was that not leaving it a bit to chance when the record of Sudan was like that?
Absolutely. I think it was a disgrace. Of course, one has to sympathize with the dynamic of that time, and I was around, as the head of the UN in the early part of the decade. The long-standing conflict, thousands of refugees and displaced, hundreds of thousands, millions, clearly, and then the genocidal war in Darfur. Obviously, the world was very anxious to come to a solution to that and stop the violence and the killing and so on and so forth. So the intention behind the international negotiators at the time was probably an honorable one. But I think they were naive, and also they were unprincipled. You know, all through history around the world, whether it is in other parts of Africa or in the great liberation struggles in Latin America, there has never been a peace agreement that has held without a track of justice and accountability. And because of the flawed nature of the Khartoum regime, the idea that somehow you could have a normal business agreement, which both sides of the business would keep, was completely naive. So the cost of this naivety is being borne now by the people of South Kordofan and Blue Nile and Abyei, apart from the continuing problems in Darfur.
I wanted to turn to the humanitarian situation, and we're hearing about the desperate situation for refugees in South Sudan and indeed in Sudan. Could you describe to us what these people are facing?
Well, terrible. I mean, I was in the Nuba Mountains myself only about a couple of months ago. And to me, it was like a sense of deja vu about what I had seen in Darfur at the worst of the genocidal crisis there in 2003-2004. The only difference being actually that 10 years later, the forms of making warfare at the disposal of the Khartoum regime is even stronger. 10 years on, the technology of war has become more modern. So you have targeted heavy artillery, you have the use of anti-personnel landmines, you have cluster munitions, in addition to militia and the attrition that goes on at the ground level, which was there in Darfur. So if you like, the Nuba and Blue Nile region of today is like Darfur of 10 years ago, except much worse. So what that means is that in the Nuba region alone, well over a million people are affected directly and indirectly. Hundreds of thousands are refugees or displaced, and Blue Nile similarly. And they are being deliberately targeted at a time that is most vulnerable for them. In other words, the crop planting season. So that with only a minute proportion of the normal agricultural area planted, because when the farmers plant, the bombers come, and scorched earth policy means that they are then, the fields are destroyed. We are staring at extreme hunger and starvation, which is already there in pockets in both Nuba and Blue Nile.
How dangerous is it, how difficult is it for aid agencies to deliver assistance?
Oh, I think it's extremely difficult for external aid agencies to deliver assistance because the government in Khartoum has said that it will not give access from Khartoum-held areas. And it has further said that if anybody tries to come in cross-border, it will, kill them. Now, having said that, I think the Western aid mentality that you can only help people by having your own Western white faces going in and delivering aid is a wrong one. It has to change. The people of the Nuba, the people of the Blue Nile, the people of Darfur, they have been working under these crisis circumstances for decades. They have developed capabilities and capacities that those who wish to help them should trust them. So it is not necessary for a huge international aid operations in a traditional way to go in. And if it can't go in for security reasons, then no aid goes in. Why not work with local organizations? Why not work with the local people who are suffering the most and who know where to target the aid and who would ensure that it goes to those in most need? I'm afraid that the aid donors, including Western governments, and the traditional Western NGOs, they are not sufficiently imaginative in this regard. And I think we need to have a different model of providing assistance. It is perfectly possible to provide aid into those regions. It just has to be done through local communities and in small, discreet ways, rather than the massive aid operations that are traditional for humanitarian crises over the past decades.
You've been quoted as saying that the denial of food is being used as a weapon against the entire population by the Sudanese government, not just using it against the armed opposition.
Absolutely. Well, and I saw this with my own eyes. This is a direct witness. Basically, what I've seen is that the Sudan government is not just targeting the military armed opposition as legitimate military targets, but it is engaged on a war of attrition against the whole civilian inhabitants of the disputed or territories. Now, what that means is that it is not just indiscriminate bombings. What I saw was targeted bombings. For example, I saw churches with roofs blown off in Nuba Mountains. And these churches and the mosques that are close by, but the mosques were not targeted, are used by civilians to run from the bombers, from the Antonov bombers that attacked them. So in a way, it was very clear, I saw for myself, that the Sudanese Air Force was targeting the places where civilians would shelter when fleeing from military confrontation on the ground. And in the right in the middle of houses and near wells and in villages, anti-personnel landmines and the cluster bombs being used. No military targets there. This is deliberate harassment of civilians, as I saw for myself, the destruction of food stocks. So, for example, precious food stocks from last year's harvest, which are to be used for keeping people alive until the next harvest comes in, have been completely burnt to the ground. You know, I never knew really properly what a scorched earth policy really is like. It's a phrase we use, but having gone on the ground and seeing the manifestations of it, it is exactly as it says. It's general scorched earth policy, and that's a crime against humanity committed by the government of al-Bashir in Khartoum.
Finally, you talked earlier there about the situation and you likened it to the terrible situation back a few years ago in Darfur. With that in mind, has there been enough pressure put on by governments to stop what's going on, and why aren't they doing more if they're not doing more?
Well, this is the most perplexing aspect of the whole case as to why the world is not doing more. Having the experience of Darfur behind us, where we witnessed the first genocide of the 21st century taking place, and some lessons were learned, and the International Criminal Court did its inquiry, and it's clear who is responsible for this. And it now become clear that exactly the same people who were indicted for those crimes against humanity are now perpetrating the crimes going on in the Nuba Mountains and also in Blue Nile. So why the world isn't doing more about it? It is because I think the idea that the problem is too big and that it cannot be solved without necessarily the Africans themselves being part of the solution. That much is true. I mean, the African Union, for example, has been remarkably silent on this issue. It should be able to do more. So is the Arab League. And at the same time, we have been very active in Syria, in Libya, and in Tunisia in the past, you see. So I think this question has to be asked from the governments themselves. In my opinion, those who stand by, including governments who could act but fail to do so, are almost equally guilty of aiding through neglect or abetting through neglect the prosecution of crimes against humanity. So this is a very, very serious charge. And I think this has to be looked into further. To give you a couple of other examples, the sort of weaponry that I saw in the Nuba Mountains, tanks, heavy artillery, cluster bombs and so on, they are supplied from somewhere. Or Khartoum can buy them on the open market by using the money that it has in the past got from its oil revenues. So somebody supplying those weapons, or somebody is actually doing the trading, which allows the Khartoum regime to get heavy weaponry, which is being used to actually decimate whole communities down there. Now, and there are no effective sanctions against Khartoum in these particular areas. There are no effective economic sanctions. There is no sanctions on arms transfers. And there is no effective sanctions against people who are directly masterminding these operations, apart from a very few at the top. There's a whole set of whole network of people involved in the economy of conducting this war. And they've been completely unsanctioned. Now, all those measures we have tried elsewhere in other situations, in West Africa, in the past, in Liberia, in Sierra Leone, and also, of course, now in Syria, and so on and so forth. So we know that when you apply sanctions, they eventually do work. So the political will that somehow has paralyzed the world in acting on in relation to Sudan is somewhat perplexing, and I hope the media and the general public will continue to apply pressure to make sure that we act in a more timely manner. I'm afraid that with the way we are at now, in the middle of 2012, it is already too late for the people in the Nuba Mountains and in the Blue Nile. It is already too late. So all we can do now is to mitigate the worst of the crisis that is undoubtedly already manifesting itself on the ground.